Meetings hearing for Monday, February 11th, 2008 to order. Welcome everyone here. A few items on the agenda, not too many. The first item on our agenda is opportunity for public hearing from scheduled for about a half an hour or so. If people have some issues they'd like to talk about that relate to the items on our agenda, ask them to either sign up or raise your hand. We don't have a sign-up sheet over there. No one did sign up, and that's because we're just such an open group. You already know everything. That's good. I like that. That's open process, Oregon, open meeting stuff. It's all good. So I see no one dying to do public testimony. Okay. Appreciate that, actually. Thank you very much. I love you.
So much for openness.
Yeah. So we'll dive into a work session, Department of Administrative Services then. Report on changes to the State Employee Compensation Plan, 2007-09 biennium. Please come forward, Ms. Collins, and your friend, whoever you would like. Any opening remarks, staff at all?
Sure, Mr. Chair, just so that everyone knows here. What this is the Department of Administrative Services is requesting acknowledgement receipt of the various comp plan changes that have been made during 2007-09. ORS 291-371 actually requires them to report these changes, but the issue is that during the legislative session, they're supposed to report them to the Ways and Means Committee. During the interim, they reported them to the emergency board. And, of course, there was not an emergency board at this point, up to this point in the biennium. The department has been writing letters to the co-chairs and to leadership to notify them. So what this is doing is they are bringing them all together at once of the changes they've made up to this point. They're reporting them now. The one issue that is not reported in here, and I think it's pointed out in our memo, is that there is the supplemental changes that were given to management service have been included, but the matching to the unions, SEIU and AFSCME, that are actually implemented on the last day of the biennium are not included in the packet that you've got so far. They are still working on those letters of agreement. I think the department will talk about that. As soon as those are put together and they're all officially signed, they will be notifying through the emergency board of those actions. I'll turn it over to the department.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Chris Katz, and I'm the interim director for the Department of Administrative Services. Actually, Darren pretty much took my opening comments, which is we are here to report. We have, I believe, sent three letters to leadership. Unfortunately, we missed one in getting the packets to you, which was our September letter. That is coming over subsequently while we're here. Hopefully we can get that passed out to you for those members that may not have seen that. But what we plan to do today is a high-level overview of what those compensation plan changes have been. Somewhat across the board, we can certainly talk specifics about any one of those groups, and then be ready to answer your questions. With me today, of course, I have Sue Wilson, the Human Resource Services Division Administrator, and then Tammy Blickman from Budget and Management. So with that, I'll turn it over to Sue, and you can get started.
Okay. We're waiting for the packages, so I was just looking. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have, I believe, a handout that, in essence, goes over the basic components of the compensation packages that have been given this biennium. Just to sort of talk about what we generally include in compensation packages, cost of living increases are included. The state contribution to health care plans is part of the compensation package. And then any adjustments within the salary ranges that are given to various classifications. For the 2007-2009 biennium.
I'm sorry, Ms. Wilson, will you re-identify yourself?
I apologize. My name is Sue Wilson. I'm Administrator of the Human Resource Services Division at the Department of Administrative Services. For 2007-09, there was a basic package which all state employees received. That was a 3% COLA effective July 1 of 07 with a minimum $80 increase. The 3.2% COLA, which will be given on November 1st of 08, with a minimum $85 increase, and fully paid health premiums for 2008 and 2009. Our health premiums are actually paid on a calendar basis, so they overlap with the bienniums. There is a 12% cap for increase in the 2009 health care premiums. There also are salary selectives that are given to particular classifications within union bargaining contracts. In addition, we also gave a management package which included the basic elements given to all state employees, and in addition to that, a 3% market adjustment, which is in essence giving back to management service employees a cost of living that was given for 1 month in 2003 and then taken away. At that time, represented employees did receive the cost of living increase, but it was taken away from management service. So that there's that 3% market adjustment. In addition, we added a new top step and removed the bottom step of the salary ranges for management service employees. That was effective July 1 of 07, and in July 1 of 08, another top step will be added, and the current bottom step will be removed. The other piece for the management package was the identification of 64 agency heads who were given a 10% differential for the agency head status. And this was largely based on recruitment, on issues of being able to retain individuals and move forward in that way. Unrepresented employees received the same package as the represented staff, and we are rolling these out. In addition, the represented employees now have received a new top step and a dropping of the bottom step for all classifications. That is effective on June 30th of 2009. We are still working through letters of agreements with agencies and finalizing all of the contracts that we have. We had another contract ratify on Saturday, so we will be getting those contracts available for signature. Once they're signed, we will be reporting.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a really broad overview of the overall compensation package for representative management service employees. We'd be happy to take questions, answer any.
I think some of the members would be interested in particular, I think you were asked to come forward with how you're going to manage some of the management increases within the budget without affecting program service delivery. I think that was part of our request. So if we hadn't heard anything on that.
Mr. Corchette, before you get to that, and I am very interested in that from DAS on behalf of all the agencies, I'd like clarification on the additional step. When we make a COLA adjustment, do we adjust each of the steps by that COLA amount?
Coacher Nolan, what we do is when a 3% COLA is added, it is added to every step on a salary range. So it is added across the board.
And all follow-ups? And each of the steps is about 5% separation?
Madam Chair, each step is about 4.75%. So it doesn't increase that amount for each. It just simply raises everything within that across the range. It's still 4.75 between the steps.
So the effect of adding a step is to give a person who is at, who is senior enough to be at the top, the effect of that compounded with the COLA is a 7.75% or roughly 8% increase in salary.
Coacher Nolan, that's correct.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Perhaps I just didn't understand this from your explanation, but how many times have you dropped the bottom step and added a top step, a different top step?
I don't know that I can tell you exact times. That is a tool that has been used frequently. In the 2005-2007 biennium, that was done once for all salary ranges.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes, please.
I'm trying to recall the testimony from last session in the General Government Subcommittee and the discussion that the committee had with DAS with respect to a comprehensive salary survey. And I understand that you're coming back with a report now, but I think if I recall your testimony correctly, you were not undertaking any kind of salary survey at the time?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we are not undertaking a comprehensive salary survey at this time. As we work through bargaining, we do salary surveys related to specific classifications, and as much as we can make matches with the market in general, we can do market surveys, but we are not undertaking the over 700 classifications that the state has.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. As I recall, again, the committee testimony, there was some angst expressed by the committee members about some of the adjustments that were being made within salary ranges, the adjustments of the steps, absent such a comprehensive policy review. And it seems from that testimony that you just delivered here this afternoon that there are lots of adjustments being made, but we still don't have this comprehensive framework against which to make any evaluations about whether or not we're doing it correctly. I would just welcome your response.
Yeah. Co-Chair Senator Johnson, I appreciate what you're saying. We try to do the best. We don't always match up with market. That's one of our issues in trying to do it across the board, especially with management. We struggle with that because Principal Exec Manager Jay isn't available out in the regular marketplace. So some of that we have to make best guesses as to how we align up skills, experience, and some of those kind of things. The comprehensive framework we would love to have, but it's very expensive generally to do as well. So in negotiations, when we work with bargaining units, they bring their issues forward, and sometimes we have good information to make those decisions, and sometimes we don't have the best information or all the information that we'd like to have to make those decisions. And in a bargaining arena, it's a give and take, and so we give and take in some of those cases. So I appreciate what you're saying, and I wish we could say we do it for every single classification, the over 700 that we have, but we don't have that data available, and it would be very costly to get it.
Thank you. See, Senator Woodson, Morgan, we'll begin. Wait a minute, Aaron. We'll begin to begin.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
My vice chair would like to speak.
I will kill the messenger because you're new. Every time I have had on this committee a report about employees, we have asked that diversity be an issue. State of Oregon has not done a good job with diversity, and I'm angry about it, number one. And number two, it doesn't make sense to have a Department of Human Resources, and we can't have that information inculcated in the regular employee base. That is the problem. I have a problem with that. And I don't want to listen to another report unless we can talk about all Oregonians in the marketplace. This does not make any sense to me. Now, so either you guys come back with it, or I'm going to be even more outraged than I am right now about this issue. Because if all Oregonians are paying taxes, and all Oregonians want to reap the benefit of their taxes, then you, as a department, should make sure that it is an inclusive action where all employees that are eligible for the marketplace have access to work for the state of Oregon. And so as soon as you can get it to me, I'd like to have that report.
Okay. That's good. Very good request. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Schrader. The figures that I have, and these are close but perhaps not exactly accurate, would be that the principal executive manager, Jay, would have had an increase of $52,800 in total compensation between June of 07 and June of 09, which is about a 35% increase. Principal Executive Manager I would have an increase of $45,000 and change. A Principal Executive Manager H would have a compensation increase of about $41,000. I don't think the debate is whether these people are worth that much money. It's in view of our revenue forecast, can we afford this kind of increase? And so my questions are a number. Could you provide the committee with a total aggregated roll-up cost of agency director increases and total compensation through 09-11, in addition to the estimated total increase in PERS liability related to these salary increases? The total aggregated roll-up cost of mid-level manager increases and total compensation through 09-11 biennium, and the estimated total increase in PERS liability related to those salary increases, and the total aggregated roll-up cost of the additional step increases promised to rank-and-file public employees, plus the aggregated cost of total PERS liability. I think that would be very helpful to understand what we're going to need to budget for this in the future in 09-11 and future biennia.
Co-chairs, Senator Wixit, we can provide that information, and some of that is included in the letters that we have submitted, I believe, and we'll double-check that. Usually we have to show the cost of the action in the current biennium and the roll-up cost for future biennium, but those are spread across a number of different areas and in some cases aren't broken out to the level that you've asked for detail, so we will get that back to the committee.
Thank you.
Ms. Gauss, would you want to go over, at least on your cover, our cover memo, we have $21 million general fund cost, $55 total funds cost, the 09-11 budget, how that is reflective of some of what we've talked about here today.
Mr. Chair, if I might, it's the roll-up cost for the implementation of the classified portion.
Yeah,
that second step. It was the information. It's a $21 million GF and about approximately $55 million total cost in 09-11 just to implement that.
For the 630.
Correct.
That's part of the issues we're talking about today, to which the center of this point. Representative Morgan.
Well, thank you. I think that there's part of this discussion that is like deja vu all over again, that we've taken up this matter several times in this body, and I think it again is an enduring example of the value of subcommittees, that we don't have to go through this in the full committee again. The questions I have relate to the overall cost of this, and what I can see in the memo from Mr. Rocco is that it says the majority of these charges are included in the $125 million SPA that was set aside in the budget, it's anticipated that because of the renegotiated part of this, that there will be an additional $21 million general fund cost and a $55 million total funds cost. So I'm just trying to get my arms around this. Is the $55 million the actual total line, or the bottom line number here, that we are going to have to rebalance to, that the agencies are going to have to rebalance to?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Morgan, yes, that's the all funds amount of that.
Okay, so if $21 million is general fund, and the balance of this is some kinds of other funds, what is that? What makes up the balance of this?
You mean by fund type?
Yeah.
I don't have the numbers right here in front of me.
Well, can you give me just a ball? Park.
Well, in general, I think about an equal number is probably federal funds, and the rest of that would be other funds. And that's a real big effort.
And other funds being like permit fees and different kinds of things.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Morgan, that's correct.
So is any of that other funds money that's started out as general fund and got washed through the system, like DAS assessments and things like that?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Morgan, yes.
I think it would be interesting to kind of get that bottom line information so that we know how much of it, I mean, it's all coming out of agency budgets, but how it actually is broken down. And then I think really just to cut to the chase, we're pretty much stuck with this no matter what the system is that we throw it out there or negotiate it under. And I'm really curious about what the impact is going to be on state budgets when they have to adjust for this.
Thank you. Senator Winters?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I would like to follow up on the co-chair's question on COLA and STEP, and whether or not the $64,000, which is the unclassified, or those that was given to agency heads, whether they also received the COLA. So the 10%, and if you factor both the COLA and the 10%, then you're talking somewhere around 13-14%, right?
Co-Chair Nolan and Senator Winters, yes. The agency directors were eligible for the 3% market adjustment, the 3% cost of living adjustment on 7107. They were also eligible, if they were at the top, for the top step adjustment upward if they were there and their salary eligibility date met that. And then they would be eligible again, and then the 10% differential that agency has got. The other thing is they would be eligible for the 3.2% in November of 2008. It can come up to a total of over 24% for agency heads, for the 64 of them.
So do we have that follow-up?
Yes, Senator.
What the roll-up will be with this particular group?
Go ahead, George.
Madam Chair, if you don't mind, George Naughton, Budget Management Division, the Administrator of Budget Management Division. Would it help the group if I walk you through the numbers and we can answer? I have a sheet that we've handed out. If we walk through some of those, I can answer some of these questions for you, I think, and maybe that will alleviate some of the confusion that's on here. Do you mind?
Senator Winters, is that responsive to your question?
If it will get me to the response to the 24% that we're talking now and how much that roll-up will be for line, because 24% is a hefty percent when we're talking about increases.
Mr. Naughton, I don't think we have the sheet you're referring to. But I do think Senator Winters deserves an answer to her question. If you have it now, or if you can get it back to us now, would be preferable.
Yeah, that breakdown. Madam Chair, Senator Winters, we don't have the breakout just for agency heads here at the table with us. We can provide that later on. Now, what we don't have is we have aggregated numbers of what the estimates are, not looking at a current 24% increase and what that individually would be, but aggregated over the system. So we can provide some of that information on an aggregated basis, but not on individual situations.
I would like the individual, and when you have it, if you would share it with all of the members of the for those names.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Senator Witz has asked for some specific information, and I wonder if we could tag one more thing on that, and you may not be able to do it, but could it be helpful to us, at least to me? I know from sort of anecdotal experience over the last 7 or 8, 9 years here that in some areas, at least in the state, as far as agency heads and others are concerned, we're way below what the market is. And it's resulted in us losing people on a regular basis. I know agencies have been through 6, 7, 8 different agency heads over a period of 10 years, and they go out and take on a similar job in industry at 2 or 3 times the salary, and we may not agree with those salaries, but that's the reality we're competing with. I also know of situations where state patrol officers have left and gone to work for cities because the pay was better. So it's not just the high people. And I've also seen a few situations where I kind of shook my head about what that person was being paid for a comparative job in the private world too. And so it kind of cuts both ways, but generally speaking seems to cut in the direction that we lose good people because we can't compete because our salaries have gotten out of sync with the commercial world. And as I said earlier, we may not agree with that commercial world, but that's the reality we deal with. If you could, when possible, give us an idea of salary ranges for similar positions in commercial world, it would be helpful to kind of keep us sort of in a sort of subjective way where we're at on these things and why we're looking at such big changes. I think some of these big changes are occurring because we kept losing people, and it was because our salaries were not high enough to maintain those people. The other issue, and this goes back to what Senator Gorley was talking about, I remember in the subcommittee we looked very commonly at issues of minority and color, and we found, generally speaking, there would be good representation in the lower salary ranges and very poor representation in the middle or upper. And I think that's the kind of information we also need, because I don't think there is access there yet in the state. Okay. We need those figures also, and it's worth a focus on those areas. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Good comments. Let's do Representative Jensen first, and Representative Hannah, and Senator Gorgon.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes.
I have a question on that, and you said it's expensive for us for you to develop a comprehensive framework for our salaries. Am I stating that correctly?
Yes.
My question back to you on this, as far as this group is concerned, as far as the state is concerned, is it not expensive for us not to?
Co-Chairs, Representative Jensen, thank you for the question. It's tough. It's tough to pay the money up front for what that would cost when, in some cases, we just can't compare with the market, or it's very hard to find comparisons. Yes, negotiations, the goal is that there's a give and take on both sides, and that's one way to help keep those increases for salary selectives in check across the board. However, to put the staff on board to do a comprehensive compensation survey, classification system look, because they go hand in hand. I mean, one of our issues is that the last time we looked at the classification system for state government was back in the late 80s, and it took 6 years to implement, lots and lots of additional employees, and there's not been a lot of desire to push that back across the goal line again, to go through that level of work to bring the compensation and classification system back around. So it's a tough call, I agree. We haven't made that call today.
If I could follow up, thank you, Mr. Carter. As Senator Johnson, I think, was correct, there's quite a bit of discussion on this when the agency was in front of the subcommittee during the interim, or during the last session. And I'm afraid there wasn't real good resolution at that time, and I'm afraid we're not getting real good resolution, at this time. I sense among all of us a lot of frustration with the way this is handled. I think it's not a matter of not wanting the state employees to have fair and just compensation, but it's the frustration we have of feeling like we're kind of maybe being manipulated in this process. Now, having at one time in my previous life been on the other side of the table when it came to negotiating salaries and so forth, I've seen and have actively participated in the use of some of the what I would call techniques that are being used by state government here to move the salary schedule. I'm expressing, I think, frustration with the way we're doing this. And I would like to see a comprehensive package put together, and I understand, Mr. Co-Chair, that if we were going to do something like that, that the Ways and Means would have to make a commitment this is something we wanted to do. And until such time as we do it, we're probably always going to struggle a little bit or a whole lot with this issue. Thank you. I just
have the comments. I think you have to be careful of what you ask for sometimes, though.
Yeah.
The cost might be much more than what we're currently able to bear. But it does bear, maybe in between now and 2009, there might be an opportunity for Ways and Means people and for our staffs to have a thoughtful discussion about what is the best way to. And it's been since the 1980s that we've looked at our whole system, and frankly, based on some decisions that have occurred over the last 6-8 months, it might be time to figure out a way and perhaps a timeline to get there. Representative Hanna, yes, sir, you've waited patiently.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Director Couch, you ran some numbers past us. I want to make sure I got them right. And what I want to search for here on the increases was the dates they were implemented. So I think you said a 3%, a 3%, a 4.75%, and then, which was the step if they qualified for that, and then a 10%, which was the paid differential piece, which totaled 20.75. When did the first 3% increase take effect?
Co-chairs, Representative Hanna on 7107.
And then the second?
Also 7107.
Okay, and the 4.75?
7107.
And the 10?
7107 for agency directors only.
Okay. Follow up, please?
Please.
And then I think the 3.2% was for November of 08.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. And just to follow up,
please.
Going along with the discussion that Senator Bates brought up about where these folks fit, I think what we find is that it is difficult to go out and do a compensation survey, and as you've made note, it's very difficult for you to even find comparatives in the private sector, if you will. But I think a measurement that's quite good, and I've yet to really get the answer to this, I think you're in a position to find the answer, and that is, if you took a look at the total number of folks who had the option of those increases we just discussed, whatever the number of directors are, and you looked at their employment history and you answered a couple of questions for us. Tell us, if you would, when you come back with this information, what's the turnover rate in those positions? Because that would be very helpful to know. And tell us also what the average tenure is of the employee who has that position. Because if you go into the private sector, regardless of the measurement of compensation, when you look at how long somebody works someplace and how often that position turns over, you'll find you get a pretty good measurement for people's like or dislike of the work they're doing. I find that we run into a lot of agency folks who really like what they do, and they appreciate the working conditions they have. And so, I mean, when you look out there in the private sector and say to yourself you're going to make a catch-up adjustment at this pace, and then you talk to yourself about what would it be like in private business to go make a catch-up like this, we'd be hard-pressed to find any place that would take this kind of an adjustment. It'd be difficult to find. So I hope you can answer the questions. How many people were up for that kind of an increase, what the turnover rate is, and what their average tenure is. And we don't need to share other private information, but those things should be pretty clear within their employment record, and it'll tell quite a story.
Okay.
We should have
that. Thank you. Let's go to Senator Gorgel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd like to go back and address the issue that Senator Carter brought forward and thank her for being consistent in providing leadership around those issues. And I also want to thank Senator Bates for affirming her request, which I would also like to join. And I also want to challenge us to look at an opportunity that we can create so that we get better information. What I'm suggesting, Mr. Co-Chair, and to our co-chairs, is that we need to look comprehensively at how we're doing in meeting the statutory language that says Oregon shall be a leader in affirmative action and in providing equal employment opportunities in the state of Oregon. And I'm referring to language that's been in statute since the 80s. in order to get that comprehensive look, I think we need a different approach to get the information. Senator Carter is requesting a report from DAS, but I would like to suggest that what we need is a report to the full Joint Ways and Means Committee, which it probably won't happen during this session, but most certainly could happen and needs to happen during the interim, where we hear from the governor's director of affirmative action, you hear from DAS, and you also hear from, we also hear from every state agency head responsible for providing leadership to meet the statutory goal. We've not done that. What we do, what our process has been, is to hear individual agency reports in our various Ways and Means subcommittees, and sometimes that monitoring is uneven. In fact, sometimes it doesn't even happen. And so what we're left with is a fragmented understanding of where we are, and that needs to change if we are serious about addressing diversity and inclusion and affirmative action and equal employment opportunities. So I'm laying that suggestion on the table for everyone's consideration. Again, we have a governor's director of affirmative action that's looked deeply at every state agency and what goals are being achieved or not. We've not invited that person to speak to this body. We have, again, the opportunity to have the governor's person, DAS, and all of those state agency heads so that we get a comprehensive look. Let's call it a big look, or another form of big look, and how we're doing as a state and meeting our diversity. We've not done that, and we're overdue, and it's about time.
We had a brief conversation after Senator Carter's remarks about not just having a good report, but indeed having perhaps one of these board meetings look at something a little more comprehensive. And Butcher and I can work with Darren on that if that's acceptable to Senator.
Can I add a specific request to that?
There's some other people ahead, but if it's real quick to that one.
It's real quick, okay. Because I was here when this building did have a lot more color. And when we were in mid and upper level management positions. And I would like for when you go back to do the comprehensive study that you do a longitudinal study that shows some history where you can pick up where you did have minorities, African Americans and others in key management positions, not only in this building, but heading up agencies. And I think it'll give us a clearer picture than just a snapshot. But it'll also tell us how we were committed in parts of our history and not committed today.
Good idea. Senator Johnson, did you have a comment?
The only other thing I think that we shouldn't lose track of in terms of looking at this comprehensive study of comparables with market outside of state service is also something that trues up the desk audits to find out is the work really being performed at the appropriate step and by the appropriate designation. I have reason to believe that those probably in many cases are grossly out of whack, up way more than down. But I just wanted to make sure that was part of the record. It isn't just the comparison to the market. It's the actual comparison to work performed with the job description, and is the job description appropriate for the classification?
I'd like to, with the committee's indulgence, maybe move on to the management package in particular, because we did ask them to bring specific information. Oh, excuse me.
Sir, I would like to ask one further question.
Pardon?
I would like to ask one further question.
Yes, please. Go right ahead.
In looking at my doodling figures here, it appears that the 24% increase in directors' compensation is 24% of the new compensation, not 24% of the original compensation. If you figure it from the original compensation, for instance, with again with your principal executive manager Jay, it's a $52,700 increase on a $152,000 salary, which is a third. And if you go to executive manager I, it goes from 138,000 to 183,000, which is a $45,000 increase, which is 33%. And it's the same thing as in the $41,000 increase in the manager H. So, Mr. Chair, I guess the point is when you and I give raises to our staff, we would certainly figure that on the bottom layer because it certainly sounds better. If it were the staff making the assumption, they might want to look at it from the 24%. It's a numbers game.
Thank you. Comment?
Co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, we'll go back and take a look at the information that you have and compare that with where we thought the base was for 7107 and see if we can't figure out how we come together on the numbers. Not having Senator Whitsitt, I just want to make sure that we're comparing the same things here.
Your assumption is, if I may, not to put words in your mouth, that the 24% is from the original base, is where I'm going.
From where people were at on 6/30/07, and then go from there. The other thing is that the increases do compound on one another. So when you go into the system, it's not that they all go in at once. You give a 3%, and then you do a 3% on top of that new base, and then on top of the new base. So there is some of that as well.
I think we could address that concern of those different numbers, if you will. That's a good segue into the management package, I think. I'll just preface it. I have some serious concerns about that, because not all managers are the same as anyone else, and I think there are some that are in different levels of management. They're heads of various small boards that got the same relative increase that the head of DHS got. That seems somewhat odd to me, and certainly I wouldn't do that in my business. Everyone gets judged in the managerial level by their performance. The other thing is, it gets back to some of the discussion on the comparables. I know that our union friends have to justify every type of increase or change and classification and show that it's really necessary, and that it's hard for me to hear that there are no comparables out there when it seems like a lot of the workers have to do that on a regular basis. So I'm just a little concerned. And I would hope you'll have a handout, I assume, with some detailed information about, you know, how you're going to implement these management changes without affecting the program.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a handout specifically on the management package today. When we get information back to you, we could add specific components about the information that agencies gave us about how they would pay for that package. We can talk about it in general today to the committee. I don't have it agency by agency what their responses were and how they would absorb those costs.
Well, that would concern me. I thought we were, maybe I'm wrong, maybe the committee has a different view, but I thought we were very specific about the level of specificity we wanted that information. So that concerns me.
We have the data. Uh-huh. I apologize. There, I believe, has been a miscommunication. I didn't realize you wanted us to bring the entire thing, but we have worked with all state agencies to get the information about how they would manage the absorption of those costs for the management package, and I have the data. I didn't bring it here. I have themes for you today about how people would do that, and I can certainly provide you with background. So my apologies if I misunderstood direction from your staff on what they wanted, what you all wanted today.
Okay, that might be sufficient. Is that okay with the committee? And we'll get the backup data at a different point in time. The only concern is, it was stated earlier, that Representative Jensen, you know, we just don't want to, we have limited time in this February session to look at this. Maybe after we get the detailed information, we may want to revisit this, unfortunately, at another e-board meeting. I think it's important for us to understand this and everyone have confidence that, you know, especially with the shortfall we're facing right now, that at least the management package that was given and above the salary pot would not implement these programs. So we're going to have to maybe implement or affect programs if the economy continues to tank. Well, continue then. I apologize.
Sure. Well, I'm going to ask George to go ahead and go through the various themes that we heard as we worked with agencies on how they would manage through the costs of that package.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, George Naughton, the Administrator of Budget and Management Division. We actually did work with Legislative Fiscal Office, and we have a binder that looks like this. The Legislative Fiscal Office has a copy of that has the response for all the agencies about how they were managed through the management package. So we do have that detail. LFO has a copy of it, and we can certainly provide a copy for all of you as well. In general, the management package, based on updated calculations, would cost about $15.9 million in the 2007-09 biennium. We're expecting it to cost about $19 million in 2009-11. But in this biennium, we're looking at about $15.9 million. So we did a process.
So, Mr. Naughton, Mr. Chair.
Question.
I believe that's general fund only, so the total cost is above that. Yes. Total funds is bigger than that.
That is absolutely correct. The total funds is closer to 45, just over 45 million for total funds. What we did is we worked with agencies over the month of December and had them lay out for us how would they absorb that 15.9 million and the 45.5 million total funds. And what they did for us is then came back after they worked through their budgets, working with our staff, and laid out what their plans would be. Roughly speaking, about 70% of the cost would be covered through vacancy savings. And again, remember, $15.9 million general fund equates to about under one-half of 1% of the personal services and service and supplies budget. It's actually closer to 0.3 of 1% of the personal services and service and supply budget. So for a number of our agencies, they did not see this as a large change. In fact, our Department of Human Services, their response back to us was that they rebalanced their major issues, and for them, this was not significant enough that they would have to take any significant management actions and deal with it. So they were looking at general turnover as being the place where they would be looking for their savings. Some of our other departments, however, like the Department of Corrections, are already facing a fairly significant budget issue, and they would be looking at taking management actions in order to cover their costs. If you look at that 70% that I said would be covered through personal services savings, about 30% of the total cost is from normal turnover, which is people leave and they're vacant for a normal period of time, and about 40% is from what they referred to as holding vacancies. So they have positions that were vacant, and they choose to have them open an extra month before they fill them. Most of those savings actually come from our public safety agencies, which fortuitously for them, they actually had a downturn in the inmate population forecast, which meant that there was a one-month delay in opening one of their institutional facilities. So they would be able to cover that through those delayed hiring of new staff. But if we're looking at reductions in agency budgets to cover the $15.9 million, roughly 70% of it would be coming from vacancy savings. The rest of it comes from a variety of service supplies reductions or other actions that they would take. Now, if the number increases and they're not covering $15.9 million, but some larger amount, if the more of the salary package was not covered, we will be working with agencies again to figure out how they would manage through those.
Thank you, Liz. To the point, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd like to pursue this issue of vacancy savings for just a moment.
Please.
Not including corrections, could you please describe for me what the impact of vacancy savings is going to have on the delivery of services and programs and the impact on the employees who are left? Are we going to be asking employees in some departments to do the work of two or the work of one and a half? Are we going to delay responding to Oregonians who have made requests for some sort of service or to sign up for something or to get a question answered? What does it mean to save this amount of money through leaving positions vacant for some period of time?
From a large budget perspective, and Legislative Fiscal Office may differ from me on this, a reduction of this size is not overly significant for most of our agencies. Remember, it's less than 0.4% for their administrative budget. For some of our agencies, like the Department of Human Services, they reported all of their savings would come through normal vacancy savings. Their staff can be, they can have up to 10% of their staff vacant at any one time because of normal turnover of those positions. So they is part of how that they run their operations. For other agencies that are holding their vacancies, like the Department of Corrections, for example, it would mean delaying the opening of a new prison, which is one of the things we talked about, or in some cases, depending on how large the agency is, it could mean more work if they're holding workload open that other people have to pick those things up. It depends on an agency-by-agency look, though.
Well, yes, very briefly. I understand that this is less than 0.4%. But I guess I'd like to be on record as saying I do have some concerns about this, because what I hear are stories about caseloads that are too heavy, about questions that aren't answered, about work that's left undone. And if we've been running on such a skinny budget for so long, it's hard for me to understand how we can easily say we're not going to feel this at a time when I thought the point was to try to turn things around, to say, well, it's really not a big deal. We're just going to make things even a little worse in some areas. I don't feel real comfortable with that. I just needed to say that. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Co-Chair Miller.
I'd echo what Representative Nathanson just said, and perhaps there was a misunderstanding in what we meant by a management plan. I'm also a bit troubled that the response is we will absorb this by delaying services to Oregonians. I would agree with comments that Senator Bates made that if we are out of sync with the compensation that's offered in the labor market that we hire from, we need to do something about that. But it was my expectation, and I thought I had been more clear, that in order to justify that, some changes in management approach needed to be made that didn't mean Oregonians didn't get services or represented positions. The real workers got delayed in filling vacancies or things like that. Essentially, co-chair and colleagues, my understanding is the legislature decided to invest certain amounts of taxpayer money in delivering services, and we defer a lot to the executive branch to deliver those services in the smartest way possible within that budget. And that's really the question I would like answered. How will the major agencies of the state still meet their performance outcomes while implementing this management decision that the executive branch has made unilaterally? But I don't know that we're going to get that answer today, and we have several visitors that we have invited for the next item on the agenda. I would suggest either later this session or very soon in the interim, we get very specific reports from at least this list of agencies. I'd like to hear from DHS. I'd like to hear from ODOT, Department of Corrections, OSP, Department of Education, and DCBS. There may be others that subcommittee chairs believe are also critical. How we will deliver to Oregonians the services, the outcomes that we invested in, while still implementing this decision. And I don't expect, Ms. Couts, you or your team to be able to be in a position to defend each of those agencies' plans, but you are the conduit that we have to them. And so I would like to pass that on as a request, and our calendar is very busy for the next 2 weeks. We may be able to accommodate it, but if not, very soon in the interim.
And probably a full breakdown report. We'll spend some time.
Yes, we'll spend
June, I think, for sure on this urgency.
Yeah.
All right, we've got Representative Shields and Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm going to pass. It's a technical question. We'll get to the agency later.
Thank you for doing so. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm really parroting in on Vice Chair Nathanson and Co-Chair Nolan's comments. And I'm thinking about the special committee that several of us on the here are a part of, having to do with the state hospital and with the treatment of people that are in the care and under the jurisdiction of the state hospital, and I'm hearing about holding vacancies as a management tool and I'm wondering about the quality of service that we are, I think, morally required to provide, and instead we're holding up these positions. In another area, in the area of corrections, I know I have a couple of correctional facilities in my district, and we've got people there that have not been able to bid for leave for 3 or 4 years because of unfilled vacancies or shortage of staff. So I have, you know, I guess some real issues here about the service, and I'd like to dig more into this, and I'm going to stop because I think my two superiors here on the committee have already done a very good job with that. Further discussion. I guess my final comment would be I thought that Representative Hanna had some very thoughtful remarks about it. In the real world, it's not just for management people anyway. It's not just comparables. We hear all the time that we have the brain drain here in the state of Oregon. In some areas, that's probably very true. But I think getting actual comparables about turnover rates and that sort of thing would be very, very helpful to juxtapose against just a comparable study, because there are certain other benefits of working for the great state of Oregon. We appreciate people like yourself hanging in there with us. That's very, very nice of you. So no further comments. We'll need a motion to adopt the report on changes to state employee compensation plan for 0709 by any.
Mr. Co-Chair, I will move acknowledging receipt of the report with the understanding that we will revisit this issue to respond to the inquiries that many committee members have made in the future.
You from Bowen? We certainly have from you. Thanks, Jordan.
And Mr. Co-Chair, I'll echo your comments as well. We are interested in making sure that the taxpayers get the best value for the investment that they're making, and we do appreciate the effort that all of you are taking to achieve that objective.
Mr. Chair, LFO recommends you acknowledge receipt of the report.
The last comment that the precocious chair will make today on this subject is that, as you know, we just suffered a pretty big reduction in our revenue forecast. We're very concerned about the future, and it would be pretty darn awkward to have these sorts of increases go in when we're looking at making possible reductions in budgets in June or September of this year. So we're just very, very concerned, and hope we'll be very deliberative in the future as we walk forward here. Okay, seeing no any objections to acknowledging receipt of the report? Seeing none? So ordered. Very good. Good discussion. Thank you for your efforts. All right. Next, we'll go to an informational meeting. This will be with the Department of Administrative Services and the Department of Justice, a briefing on the Clark versus OHSU decision. We're going to have some invited testimony from some of our other impacted partners, and we will have them come up after we hear the presentation. Any opening remarks, Alex?
Mr. Chair, he passed around a piece of memo from the Department of Administrative Services that was just providing some additional information you had requested at your meeting in January on fuel consumption. That's just for information. We didn't want to confuse you. It's being passed out now. We just didn't want to confuse you. Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Chris Kalski, Interim Director for the Department of Administrative Services. How we thought we'd do the presentation today for to give you some background on the Clark versus OHSU case
is that we'll have Mayor Williams from the Department of Justice do an overview, really getting into some of the legal issues that the state is facing. And then I'll have Terry Sally, the state's risk manager, talk a little bit about how the state is approaching it from a risk strategy. And then, as you have indicated, you have invited others, such as cities and counties, OHSU, to get their take, because each group does have a little bit of different take about how this does affect them. So I think it's great that you're going to have different groups coming up. What we present to you today is the state of Oregon issues in relationship to the case. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mary to get going here.
Okay. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Mary Williams from the Department of Justice. And what I want to do is provide a very simple overview of some of the issues in the case, some of the work that we've been doing around the case, and really to focus in on the questions that the case has raised. Because unfortunately, this is one of those decisions that creates more questions for us than it has answered. It's important to start with understanding the narrow focus of the decision. This case arose out of a medical negligence claim against Oregon Health Sciences, OHSU, and some individuals. And in the claim, the pleadings that the plaintiffs had presented to the court, they alleged that they had suffered $12 million in economic damages, $5 million in non-economic damages. And simply based on those pleadings, the defendants, OHSU and the individuals, responded at that pleading stage. So what that means for the case and the court decision is that you assume that everything in the pleading by the plaintiffs is true for purposes of resolving all the legal issues. So we start with an assumption that those were the damages in the case. The defendants asked that that two state laws be applied to the case. First of all, for OHSU, they applied the cap under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. For the individual defendants, they applied the substitution statute that allows the state to say, as for those individuals, we will substitute the state, or in this case, OHSU, as the defendant, and then we apply the cap. And what that meant was that in spite of the amount pled in the case, the actual damages that would be paid out under those two statutes was $200,000 under the cap. So the plaintiffs argued that combination of the tort claims cap and the substitution statute violated their rights under the Oregon Constitution. What the Oregon Supreme Court focused on is the remedies clause in Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution. And we've got some history with the court about what that clause means. And what the court has said that means is that if an individual could recover in 1857, and the reason 1857 is important is that's when the Oregon Constitution was being framed and when that remedy clause was being drafted. And so the court looks back to 1857, and it says that the remedy clause protects claims that existed in 1857. And so the remedy clause protects, and I'm going to quote a bit from the opinion, the right to obtain a remedy for injury to interest in person, property, and reputation under circumstances in which Oregon law provided a remedy for those injuries in 1857. So that's what we know the court has said that part of the Constitution means. What did it mean in this case? Well, in this case, the first question was whether there was any problem in applying that cap to OHSU. And the court said no, there wasn't a problem in doing that, because when you look back at 1857, the state had sovereign immunity for claims. And the OHSU is an instrumentality of the state. So when you compare what the plaintiffs would have been able to get in 1857 with what they were able to get in this case, there wasn't a problem, because in 1857 they couldn't have gotten anything from the state, including an instrumentality like OHSU. So applying the tort claims cap actually still means that the plaintiffs got something that they wouldn't have been entitled to in 1857. But then the court went on, and the second part of it is to look at the individual defendants. And it gets more complex when you're looking at those, because it's not only applying the cap, but it's the substitution provision that says that the state can step in and be the defendant instead of the individual named defendants. And the court said when you do that, you get a different result, because it's very clear that for medical negligence claims in 1857, the plaintiffs could have recovered against the individuals for the full amount of their damages. And so, because we're looking at the pleadings, we'll look at the amount that was alleged in the pleadings, and we then compare that what they could have had in 1857 with what they had under the substitution statute and the Tort Claims Act. And the court has made it very clear that the legislature can substitute remedies. You can change things. That's not a problem under the remedies clause. But what the court has said is you can't substitute a remedy if it is an emasculated remedy. And in this case, frankly, the court said it's easy. When we get to that point of the analysis, we compare the amount alleged in the pleadings that we have to assume is the true amount in the case to the $200,000. That's an emasculated remedy, and so it violates the Constitution as applied in this case. The court does not answer a number of questions that we have to now try to work through to really understand what is the impact of this decision for the state, what does it mean for us going forward as we try to project costs, and how do we respond to this, and what options might you consider in responding to this. When I read a number of the media accounts, I'm often surprised to see that they will simply say that the court said that the cap is unconstitutional. And it's very important that we recognize that that's not what they said. What they said was you have to look at each of these cases. It's only an as-applied question of how do things look for a particular case compared to what it would have looked like in 1857. And so I've identified four questions that are significant unanswered questions that we're trying to work through, but it's going to take some time before we have answers as to what those where we are with those questions. But briefly, I'll touch on them for you. The first are procedural questions. As I said, this case came up based on simply what the pleadings were. It wasn't a trial. There wasn't a jury finding of the actual damages. But now in future cases, we're going to have to litigate some of these issues and decide how the issues get raised, how they get heard by the trial court. Do we simply proceed with the individual defendants in the case and wait until there's a final jury determination of the amount of damages and then decide whether there's a constitutional problem? Do we try to somehow bifurcate these claims so that we can decide this issue up front? And if so, how does that work procedurally? What does this mean for settlement discussions, where you may not have an answer in terms of the amount of the damages that a jury would find, so you may not be able to assess the value of a settlement as well as we are able to do now? And those procedural questions are very important because, as I think you'll hear, that most of our cost in these cases have to do with the litigation costs of the cases themselves, as opposed to, we're not simply looking at the actual damages payout in the cases. We also have to consider what does it cost to get to that point in the cases. So that is one set of unanswered questions that we have coming out of this opinion. A second is, what are the claims that are actually covered by this? It's very clear that not all courts are covered by the remedy clause. What the court has said in prior cases is it's only those that affect an absolute right protected by the remedy clause in 1857. Well, what is an absolute right? We don't know. And so one of the things we'll have to find out is what are the parameters of that phrase, an absolute right protected by the remedy clause. And unfortunately, the only way we find that out is through litigation around those kinds of questions and allowing the questions to be resolved by the trial courts and then by the state appellate court. The second question that is similar is whether the defenses to claims that existed in 1857 also apply to these questions. And if so, what were they and how would they limit recovery? We've begun doing some of the research in this area, and it's for the attorneys who, especially in appellate, who like nerdy questions, this is a great law school exam question. It's very difficult to find answers because it's an area of research that we are not normally looking at. We're having to go back and figure out what did the law look like in 1857. And then again, once we even we're finding that information out, we'll have to test our theories about how that applies in these cases in the trial courts and to the state appellate courts before we really know what's the impact of this decision on state litigation. Let me give you an example, though, of how it might work. In 1857...
Ms. Williams, we probably will want to summarize, perhaps, some of our legal members may find this a lot more fascinating and understandable than a literal country veterinarian, but I appreciate the complexities.
Co-chairs, I will do my best to keep it as simple as possible, and I can cut to the bottom question here. The last one that I have on my list is that the court has, in other cases, said that a substituted remedy is okay. We don't know how close it has to be to what could actually be recovered in 1857 to really know whether it's okay. In one case, the court said that a claim of $600,000 and a cap of $100,000, that was okay. We don't know what that means, but what it is clear is that simply raising the cap doesn't resolve these questions that we have to answer, because unless the cap is practically unlimited, we're still going to have some of these claims that go beyond the cap, and we're going to have to resolve these questions in those cases. So, those are some of the areas that we're working on. Those are areas that we will be looking to litigate and to try to get some answers. But at this point, as I said at the outset, I think that the questions raised by the opinion are greater than the answers that we have in the opinion.
Very good. Good. Thank you. Let's go on with the rest of the testimony. We'll come back. We can ask questions of either of the panelists, if that's all right.
Thank you. Co-chairs, hopefully you have this presentation. That's what we'll be working with as Terry moves through what the state's risk response is in light of what some of these legal questions that Mary has just talked to you about are.
Thank you. Terry?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Terry Selling. I'm the state's risk manager. The first slide that you may be looking at in your handout on page 2 outlines strategies that risk management devised in 2006 in anticipation of the Clark decision. There are 4 points on that slide. We determined that we would require a supplemental actuarial study with multiple tort cap scenarios. We determined that we would explore purchasing commercial excess liability insurance. The state is fully self-insured or self-funded at this point. We don't buy commercial excess liability coverage today. We determined that we should review other state tort caps for comparison to Oregon's, and that we would review the state of Washington program to get a sense of what our sister state was experiencing. They have no tort caps, they're highly self-insured, and they do buy commercial excess liability insurance. On slide 3, the strategies that we just outlined, we went into full execution on December 28th when the decision was released from the Supreme Court. We immediately contacted our actuaries to require a supplemental actuarial study. I define this as supplemental because we have a normal study done on a biennial basis for workers' comp property and tort liability. This is off cycle. So again, we requested a supplemental study. We knew that we would use that study for multiple purposes, including the second strategy that we're outlining here, which is pursuit of commercial excess liability insurance. It's a piece of information that the insurance underwriters will be looking at and, in fact, are looking at today. Part of the process to pursue obtaining commercial coverage was our risk management staff obtaining from the agencies consolidated applications, which is really what we call exposure or risk information, from approximately 140 agencies, boards, and commissions. This included multiple programs within a single agency, multiple types of applications and data. We also reviewed and manually recoded 10 years of claims data to mirror the commercial insurance coverage lines of applications. To give you a sense of the voluminous nature of this information, we shipped 2 boxes of information to our insurance broker on Friday. On slide 5, the 3rd and 4th strategies that we had outlined in 2006 and which are in execution are again updating a review of the state, other state tort caps and laws.
if you look at the 50 different states, you'll find 50 different approaches. Interestingly, the state of Oregon's 200-550, my shorthand version of our tort caps, is not necessarily out of line with the limits that are in place in other states. Having said that, there are states who do not have tort caps. We also have had more intense conversations with our sister risk management professionals in the state of Washington to understand what type, frequency, and severity of claims have they been experiencing, and what insurance policy are they using, what are the terms and conditions. On slide six, strategies that we added in 2008 with in partnership with various of the DOJ divisions, including with the DOJ Business Transactions Unit, we're looking at the indemnification and insurance language in our state contracts. Mary's already outlined the review of the 1857 claims covered by the Constitution's Remedies Clause. In partnership with DOJ Trial, we've updated our claims and litigation strategies, again, in anticipation and in preparation for the variations in claims and suits that we'll get. And we've updated our immunities manual. On slide seven, what did we keep in mind as we began executing our strategies? Pre-Clark, our biennial state tort liability risk charges were running roughly $45 million per biennial. This is the baseline that we keep in mind as we go forward with the strategies. That $45 million included damages, defense costs, and administrative costs. Also keeping in mind is the fact that the state's exposure or risk, we have a minimal medical malpractice exposure. I think we looked at about 20 years' worth of claims, and our med-mal exposure was only 7% of our liability claim types. Only lower than that was our auto liability at about 3% of our claim types. I think the most important point on this slide, and Mary's alluded to it already, is the final one. The defense costs are greater than 50% of the state's tort liability costs from 1990 through 2007. And we must note that tort caps do not limit the defense costs. On slide 8, the strategies that we've outlined are leading us to pursuit of a combination of self-insurance and commercial excess liability insurance, and that strategy is intended to mitigate some of the uncertainties around the Clark decision. Our plan, we hope, will provide a measure of budget stability and public asset protection, hopefully reaping the best value for taxpayers' dollars while protecting the state's assets from potentially catastrophic losses. We also believe this strategy will enable us to have an annual adjustment or readjustment of our strategy as the information begins to develop on the type of claims, the frequency, and the severity of the losses being claimed. Again, we're looking for flexibility in our strategy, and that's outlined on the point on slide 9. We believe this combination of pursuit of self-insurance and commercial excess insurance will give us the flexibility to continue to manage or self-manage litigation that helps achieve public policy objectives. An insurance carrier may wish to settle a lawsuit. The state may need to pursue through to the end for reasons of public policy. On slide 10, and probably a particular note to the committee, is the fact that we have settled on a budget number for 09-11 of $71 million. Keep in mind our baseline in the past biennial for tort liability coverage has been around $45 million. We will not be increasing or adding to the charges already billed and collected from our agencies for the 07-09 liability risk charges. We will absorb the cost of the $71 million in the 09-11 risk charges. And we also want to reinforce again, this is an annually renewable and adjustable strategy. So we're trying to maintain as much flexibility and nimbleness, if you will, in the strategy as information continues to develop. On slide 11, and I think this is important not just for the state, but for some of our public entity partners who are here today, the public entity fiscal impact cost drivers will be in statutory level of tort caps, implementation of other types of tort cap reform, and medical malpractice tort reform is the one most frequently alluded to. The type, frequency, and severity of claims experienced post-Clark,
existing and emerging and unpredictable exposures. And the one I refer to here that captures most people's attention is what I determine or describe as internet liability. And the first thing that you may think of are breaches of privacy. Finally, the final potential fiscal impact factor is going to be the purchase price of commercial excess liability coverage. And we must keep in mind that it isn't just all our losses and our risk profile that drives that cost. It's also the insurance marketplace. We're currently in what is described as a soft market cycle. So at this point in time, liability coverages are not as expensive as they have been in the past. The final two slides in your handout on page 12 is the glossary of some of the terms that I've used today, and page 13 is simple contact information for Chris and myself.
Thank you very much. Very, very good information. I guess in the interest of time, I would, and our panel, other panel that's asked, why don't we have them come up, if you wouldn't mind just setting aside. I'm sure they get a lot of questions, though, so if you can hang with us, I would appreciate that. Let's get the School Board Association people up first, if that's okay. And we'll do the city people, the county people, and hear from OHSU.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Co-Chairs Schrader and Nolan, and members. I'm Tricia Yates. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon School Boards Association. We represent the 1,400 volunteer elected board members in the state. With me today, Rebecca Cook, OSBA attorney. To my right, she is also an attorney for the Pace Insurance Company, representing school districts on behalf of their insurance company, Pace being the Property and Casualty Coverage for Education program, the insurance program formed by the Special Districts Association and OSBA in 2006 to serve the needs of school districts, ESDs, and community colleges. To my left is Angie Peterman, the OSBA Director of Administrative Services and Executive Director of the Oregon Association of School Business Officials. We thank you for the opportunity to present information to you today on the impact of Clark v. OHSU on school districts. Ms. Cook will offer our testimony, and Ms. Peterman and I will be available for your questions. So with that.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Cook. I was asked to discuss what the impact will be on school districts. The first that I think has already been discussed is just that it'll be, tort claims are not necessarily our most expensive cases. Those are the federal civil rights claims and employment cases. So we're talking just about tort claims, which is a lower percentage of those insured claims. This will make those tort claims more difficult to settle. More in defense costs, jury trials will become more attractive. In the case of school districts, we tend to have younger plaintiffs. We're talking about students that are having accidents, and when we're talking about the damages, they're going to be a lot more just because their age. They're going to live longer and so have more losses in earning capacity and that kind of thing. We've seen impacts in terms of school board members who have opted not to run for school boards because it's a volunteer position and they cannot be assured that they won't be personally liable, no matter how much we assure them of that fact. In terms of school programs, we're concerned about those classes that tend to have more accidents just because we're talking about children and, for instance, those career-related classes, the woodworking classes, shop class. We tend to have a lot of claims in physical education classes, athletics. We're also talking about those just catastrophic claims that can occur with car accidents, with bus accidents. That's what we're concerned about with Clark. In terms of numbers, I think everyone will tell you that it's just too early. I know that the Pace Insurance Program is talking to their reinsurance carriers and deciding if there will be a percentage increase, and then that would then be translated to higher costs for schools.
Mr. Chair, having said that, we'd be open to the committee's questions. I do want to mention that we've heard mention of an interim committee on tort reform. We'd be very eager to be a part of that and be at the table in helping address this issue.
Very good. Good testimony. Aren't we, let's see. Good. Are you going to stay for the rest of the hearing? Or maybe have you set back and we'll just go through everybody, if that's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can I get the cities to come forward, please? We've got Mike McCauley and Mark Branch. for being with us.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting us. I'm Mike McCauley, Executive Director of the League of Oregon Cities, and with me is Mark Rausch, the General Counsel of CIS, which is the combined pool of the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties. Without repeating other folks, I think it's fair to say that there's a great deal of unsettled area, and it's an area that will not be settled anytime soon. It's been 17 years since the tort caps themselves have been changed or revisited. Our position at the League in the last session was that a revisiting of those tort caps was an important thing to undertake to adjust them to be more, I think, reasonable in light of the inflationary changes that have gone forward since 1991. As we look at people coming together and acting through government, the state has made some important policy decisions to both try to address the fiscal needs of government, and as the school boards were discussing certain activities that have risks, that we balance that with the need to also adequately and justly respond to damage that occurs by virtue of some failure in terms of negligence. And we also believe that with the long view of looking at these unanswered questions, as well as I think addressing the caps themselves, that we would be very interested in participating should there be an interim committee. The governor's office hosted a meeting last week, and there were a number of very fine legal minds that were addressing, as was outlined by the Department of Justice representative, a number of those issues that I think are necessary to incorporate into a holistic view of how do we respond to Clark, both in terms of perhaps more expeditious means of providing recompense to persons who are injured more efficiently, and at the same time providing some type of certainty so that in the post-Measures 5 and 50 worlds that we can draw an appropriate balance between the needs of government and schools and the needs to adequately address damage that's occurred. Mr. Rausch has more specific information in terms of some of the uncertainty, but again, I think at a less of a detail level to just simply echo the fact that we do face uncertainty in terms of reinsurance as well as setting rates.
Thank you. Mr. Rausch.
Thank you, Co-Chair Schrader and committee members. Again, I'm Mark Rausch, General Counsel of City County Insurance Services Trust, which is very similar, I guess, to PACE. You just heard from a representative of PACE, Rebecca Cook, and I'll try not to be repetitious. I agree essentially with the comments that she made, an important one being that as with them, our experience in covering cities and counties for liability exposures is that the very large claims over the years have been civil rights and employment claims, which are not subject, never have been subject to a tort cap or anything like a tort cap. But the other big piece of the exposure that we cover is the typical negligence claims and other tort claims that are subject to the tort cap. And the effect of Clark has been to, in effect, eliminate that cap. Now, as was explained earlier, you know, the cap is still there in a sense. It hasn't per se been ruled unconstitutional, but in an as-applied sense, there's a great deal of uncertainty. And what we do know is that for very large torts, very large high damages torts, there is, in effect, no cap in place now. That changes the goalposts significantly for public entities in Oregon. What does that translate to into in terms of impact on cities and counties? Whether they can cover these risks, manage these risks either by buying traditional insurance, which frankly very few do anymore in Oregon. They can self-insure, some of the larger ones do, as you've heard, or they can collectively pool that risk, which is what we are and what's been done with increasing popularity over the last 17 years or so in Oregon. So we operate much like an insurance company, but instead of paying insurance premiums to an insurance company, they make contributions to that pool, and it has to work very much the same way. We have to figure out with actuarial help what it's going to cost as close as we can to cover the risks that we're pooling, and we self-insure that up to a certain level, and we buy reinsurance over the top of that. Traditionally, we've been self-insuring up to $500,000, which is kind of consistent with the tort cap, and in effect, we kind of reinsure the amount over that, which is essentially dealing with civil rights and employment claims. In the face of Clark, post-Clark, as a result of that case, obviously our costs, what we're going to have to charge them to cover that tort risk, is now going up just because the cap is gone. Again, we haven't had a lot of experience in the past with claims that have bumped into that or would have exceeded that had it not been for the tort cap, but that reality is there now, and it was not there before, and there is that potential for a large claim to come in, so we're going to have to address that, and certainly our reinsurers are going to have to charge us more because of that additional potential exposure. So cities and counties are going to see a higher contribution to the pool, which you can think of as being the equivalent of an insurance premium to pass that risk along to the pool. In addition to that, you know, that kind of addresses a higher rate for the coverage that they buy. They should also be thinking about carrying higher limits now. Typically, in the past, they may have carried just $500,000 in limits. We've never thought that was enough, but a lot of them carry $2 million, $4 million. We offer up to $5 million in coverage, or through special arrangement, even up to $10 million. But the question becomes much more germane now. How much is enough? I mean, in the past, they knew that they didn't have anything to worry about on state tort claims with that kind of a limit. Now they do. So they should be carrying higher limits, and those will be higher limits at a higher rate. So just those costs are going to be an impact on cities and counties going forward. We don't know how much, but it will be an impact. I think another impact on cities and counties that isn't as directly related to insurance, but it could be a very dramatic impact, I guess, and that's this sort of lurking potential out there now for the huge sort of mega claim that we haven't had and wouldn't expect to see a lot of, and the fact that the Clark decision is there isn't going to increase the likelihood of that bad event. But let me give you an example that you might recall from recent history that's a very, very real possibility in Oregon or any place else. It's in Rhode Island. Just a few years ago, you may remember there was a horrible fire. It was called the Station Fire, a nightclub that was crowded with people, and there were a whole series of mistakes that were in place, and a fire happened as a result of a rock group that was playing there using pyrotechnics, caught the whole building on fire. There was there was flammable soundproofing there. The doors opened in instead of out. Exits were blocked. A whole perfect storm, I guess, of mistakes resulted in, I think, 100 people dying and many, many serious injuries. So many, many millions of dollars in claims, lawsuits against everybody you can imagine, including the city for issuing a permit and the fire department for inspections and so forth. That's exactly the kind of claim that, while unusual, could result in a city in Oregon or any place else facing many millions of dollars now in liability, whereas before this, under the tort cap, that's the kind of claim that would have been shut off after $500,000 for any number of claims. That claim, if they had $5 million in coverage through insurance or through our program, that's probably not even going to cover their exposure. And that may bring into focus a very real possibility of what do you do when a city doesn't have the money to pay a judgment. And the statutes provide for passing a levy if you can, or making installment payments, but it could put a city into a very serious situation of even bankruptcy. I think this will result in more employees being named in lawsuits. As you've heard, they will still be indemnified by their public entity employer, but there are other complications involved in being named in a lawsuit. Credit reports and so forth can get kind of ugly, and that was one of the considerations in passing the substitution clause originally, was to avoid that, the difficulty of public public employees being named in lawsuits. It will be harder to settle claims. Again, I'm not going to be repetitious. You've heard that. I agree with that. It's going to be more costly and more difficult to settle claims. I think there could also be implications, and this is more the risk management hat that we wear at CIS, but we get asked questions about what's it going to cost us if we do this or that activity, and some are more risky than others. One that comes to mind, for example, and these may be very desirable from a public service standpoint, public transit. Is one that's considered very risky, as you might imagine, from a liability and risk standpoint. That, with the tort caps in place, it was $500,000. It was something you could budget for, you could insure, you could cover, and you could not be worried about that risk and, in fact, jeopardizing your ability to do business as a local government. Now, under Clark, a disastrous bus accident could result in the kind of mega claim scenario I was talking about before. So not only is there that risk, but there's also a city in trying to decide whether to provide that service might have that on their mind when they're deciding whether to spend their money on that desirable but risky service as compared to some other less risky use of their public funds. I've probably rambled on long enough. I'll try to answer any questions you have later, but thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming forward. Let's get the county folks to come on up.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and I think you've met Mr. Rauch, who also represents counties in terms of a lot of the tort liability issues that we face. There are not a whole lot of differences between us in terms of cities and counties, nor more that I could add. There are, however, some additional questions. I think the important factor that I would like to leave you with is the information that Mary Williams indicated at the very beginning of her testimony, and that is that this case gives us more questions than answers. There are more that would apply to local governments in addition to the ones that have already been described to you. But in the interests of time, and reluctance on the part of the committee to get into too much detail about this, I'd be pleased to just answer questions, including those, if you'd like to know what they are.
Okay. Maybe before we do that, if you don't mind, I appreciate your brevity, and I appreciate that we're all facing this. That's one theme that's coming through, no matter what branch of government or public service you are. Maybe we should get Oregon Health Sciences University up here, and then we'll go to the questions, if that's all right. Thank you very much.
I'm really late for this time.
Yeah, maybe not.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Joe Robertson, president of OHSU, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to be engaged in this very important discussion. Since it's late in the day, I will try and summarize some of my remarks, but I would be obviously happy to answer any of your questions. The functional loss of the tort cap has already had a very major impact on OHSU. The loss to us is the equivalent of $30 million in indirect state support. And we have, in our efforts to adjust to this, had to basically switch from our five-year plan, which was protecting and strengthening all of our programs, to preserving the core of OHSU. This is our new and ongoing financial reality, and it has had significant impacts to our programs and our budgets. Some of those I will mention later. The question that I most often ask is, why $30 million? As you've heard in the previous testimony, this is not an easy assessment to do. It's very made difficult in part because this is really running to contrary to the prevailing theme across the country, which is the imposition or creation of tort caps. So there aren't states that have actually, and health systems that have had experience with losing the tort cap. Most people are moving into an environment where their analysis is, what does it mean now that we have a tort cap? We have arrived at this number really by several different means. First, we did seek independent outside consultation and advice, and we received a range of estimates, and the $30 million is really in the midst of that range. We felt we substantiated that by obtaining an estimate for private coverage or coverage provided in the private market, first dollar coverage, and to cover the physicians alone, and that does not include the health system, the hospital, or our other providers, was $39 million. So really for half the package, if we were to buy this in the open market, it was going to be more than this $30 million estimate. So we think that that this $30 million is a real number, and to use any other number would not be prudent and would not accomplish that objective of protecting our core. We must not under reserve, not only because of the obvious financial implications, but we can't come back and do this again and again, or we will definitely we will drive our faculty away. They will be very concerned about that. Just for your benefit, Aon was the outside consultant. This is an international risk management and insurance consulting firm based in the Midwest with 500 offices in 120 counties with extensive experience as it pertains to court cap issues. Now, earlier I was planning to go through some of the specific impacts, but you have received a sheet, I think, which really rolls those up, and I think a lot of you have become familiar with some of these. I would say each and every one of these has been painful. These were not done arbitrarily. We designed, before we embarked upon this, we gathered leaders at OHSU together and established a set of principles by which we would make these cuts. You won't go into all those principles, but chief among them was the question, is this a unique service in Oregon? Is this something that will not be provided if OHSU does not provide it? And that was certainly one of, if not the guiding principle. To go to a specific example, I think a specific example always brings this home, and some of these cuts have obviously been in the news, but let's, as a specific example, consider a program that potentially could be cut. This still isn't for sure. We're doing everything we can to save every possible program, but one of the potential program reductions is at our Russell Street Clinic, which is a dental clinic that does provide dental services for many of the underprivileged in our community. I want to contrast that for sake of discussion with our child psychiatry residency program. Both of those programs lose in excess of $500,000 a year. We can't continue an unlimited number of such programs. The dental services, quite honestly, there are other providers in the state that could provide those services. Perhaps they are not, but they could. If we at OHSU do not maintain a child psychiatry program, there would be no child psychiatry program in the state. So I think those two programs show the contrast and show the type of decision-making that we embarked upon. I also want to assure all of the committee members that we have done everything possible to minimize the actual program reductions. If you look at how we are accommodating $30 million of effectively accommodating $30 million of lost revenue per year, you will see that 60% of it is in non-programmatic areas. Okay, that is, we have actually lowered our financial targets, not enough that we think it is in any way a threat to the institution, but we've discussed this at length with our board. We were hoping over the next several years to raise our bond rating. We will now be content with a BBB+ bond rating. We have slightly reduced our days of cash on hand in our future financial projections, but again, not enough to create any real financial uncertainty, and we have reduced some of our target margins, which will have the effect of generating less capital for us to invest in future physical plant expansions. Again, I will be happy to answer any of those specific questions, but I'll try and draw this to a close. In summary, from our perspective, any cap would be better than no cap. The critical issue is that from a functional purpose now, there is no cap. if we just consider the concurring opinion that was rendered in CAP in Clark, which alluded to a $1 million, $3 million cap, the impact to OHSU would have been $5 million a year rather than $30 million a year. This would be an inconvenience, but this would not be a budget crisis. So, again, over 5 years, that's a $125 million difference. As the previous testimony has suggested, even though that OHSU has been thrust in the spotlight by this topic, this is not about OHSU. This is about the state of Oregon, and the cost of the tort cap loss will be lost services for citizens all across the state. I certainly don't have the wisdom of Solomon and know where the tort cap should be set. I do feel strongly, and OHSU believes that there should be a tort cap. I'm glad this discussion is commencing, because this is an important public debate that has to weigh the rights of the individual against their collective good to society. Thank you very much.
Very good testimony.
Well, what's the pleasure of the committee? Have Dr. Robertson stay here, or get the original DOJ gas people up? Sense of the body? My co-chair, do you have a sense? You have lots of good sense, but you have a jugular.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates will give me a few moments to collect my thoughts.
Senator Bates.
Mr. Chair, this is an issue that I've worked on for 8 years in this building. It's not new. I would first say to all those who have testified today as a physician, welcome to the club. Enjoy yourself. It's an exclusive club in the past, but it's not so exclusive anymore. And welcome to some reality here. This is a very, very complex issue. We're not going to cover it in 9 or 10 minutes, and we shouldn't try to, is number one, okay? Physicians lost their cap 7 or 8 years ago, I forget the exact date now, and we were told that time it didn't make much difference, that it's not really that important, but apparently, maybe for you guys it is. When you start talking about tort reform, you get into some really circuitous arguments at times, but there are things that I haven't done in other states. Oregon is one of the 7 or 8 states that is redlined by the American Medical Association and other organizations as a state in which there is no tort control at all, and many people will not come to practice the state because of that. We face shortages of certain types of physicians. Now this thing has been opened up to a much wider group, and I think what it speaks to, Mr. Co-Chair, is an opportunity to sit down in the interim, and maybe coming into 2009, and look at this thing more globally than just from a physician's point of view or just from physicians' points of view, but look at it from the entire state's point of view. And since the last statement made by you, I think, was really correct, balancing the individual against the whole, because we do want people protected who have been hurt. We do want that, but this has gotten out of hand. And I'm leading up to actually one question, and I'll get off it here. The question is this, Mr. Co-Chair, and this is to you. We know that the cost of premiums paid and the cost of settlements paid out is significant. But even more significant, probably in the neighborhood of 15% of the actual cost of health care in the state, which is about $22 billion a year, about 15% of that is the result of defensive medicine practiced by hospitals and physicians trying to avoid tort situations. OHSU has been a little bit immune to that because of the cap you've had. And I'm going to ask you, have you tried to calculate into this what you think will happen as your physicians and nurse practitioners and others who supply health care to the state start changing how they do things and what that might cost your bottom line?
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Bates, we did not take that into our analysis. This was difficult enough as it was that we did not anticipate any specific change in the practice patterns. We think our practice patterns are governed very closely by our quality outcome measures and certain critical pathways. And those are, I think, more than many health systems. We are able to monitor those at OHSU, so we did actually not take that into effect.
Follow up.
I would ask you to go back and think about this. You have all the quality outcomes you want. You have all the health outcome-based information you want. But when your individual practitioner starts bringing it up, being individually sued,
behaviors dramatically change, I would ask you to watch that. It's going to add a lot more to your, I think, your bottom line than this does. Add 15% to your overall costs, and you're probably pretty close to where it's at, and that comes from your own research at your institution.
Coach Nolan, did you want to comment?
I would like to, and I am mindful of the time. I very much appreciate the testimony from all the panels that we've had. I suggested to my co-chair that we bring representatives from all these groups so that the committee had an understanding of the breadth of the impact of this decision, that while Dr. Robertson and his team at OHSU have felt the most immediate impact, that they are not alone in feeling the impact of this decision. From what I have heard today, and I hope that this has sunk in with some of my colleagues here, this is an issue that's extremely complex. It is not just about a number, it is about a number and some level of balancing of individual interests and collective interests, but it's also about how we manage the services that are affected by these suits. And the other impact I walk away from this is it's incredibly urgent. Dr. Robertson has talked about, and OSBA has talked about, probably the most significant impact is our ability to attract and retain talent in a broad range of public activities. Employment, volunteer board service, a lot of areas. So I think this is the kind of thing that cries out urgently for a very active response from the legislature, certainly with a fiscal impact, and members of this committee should be involved in that, but also there are huge policy aspects that our colleagues who serve on policy committees should be involved in. We're not going to solve this in the next 3 minutes, or even if we stayed 3 hours tonight, we would not solve it. But I hope that the message is it needs attention immediately. And we ought to encourage that work to be done now, to come back as soon as possible, January at the latest, with a resolution, because if it's a $25 million difference every year, 6 months costs $12.5 million worth of services to Oregonians that can't be delivered until we resolve this.
So we've got Senator Johnson.
I would pass. Madam Co-Chair covered many of the points that I was going to offer.
Senator Wilson?
Yes, just a quick question. Thank you. Dr. Robertson, rural physicians have been limiting their practices by exposure to liability costs and the cost of insuring those procedures for a number of years now. When OHSU curtailed their services, did you take into consideration the increased liability in the dental facility and the increased liability in some of the rural areas and when you eliminated those?
Co-Chair, Senator Whitson, I don't know if we did that explicitly, you know, as specifically as you addressed. We did certainly consider very carefully the impact of our actions, and wherever possible, we are trying to develop transition plans so that we find a way to have as many services as possible provided for all patients across Oregon. And we still have over 200 outreach programs. What we are very much aware of and what we have looked at, because for years the data was not there, but the data now very clearly shows a correlation between the existence of a tort cap and the ability to recruit physicians to a state and the ability to place those physicians in rural settings, and it is now unequivocally clear.
Thank you. And a follow-up comment, if I would. I really didn't hear it addressed very well today, I don't think. We've had a situation where you can only sue the king and his employees for $200,000, and that has not led many lawyers to take on the state for a contingency fee that is a part of only $200,000. I think that with this change in ruling, that we may find the floodgates open, if not a tsunami, of lawsuits where the tort lawyers now have an opportunity to have a contingency on something a lot larger than $200,000.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd like to flag something that I'd like to hear about in the future, not for today, but something that I want to have some information about. It was raised in one of the early presentations. The concept of internet liability is one of those new areas that's increasing for us. Breach of privacy, and as the state of Oregon, as well as other public entities in the state, do more in the way of e-commerce or people filling out forms, as we do all sorts of business now over the internet and web-based, our exposure is increasing rapidly, and we even heard plans for new activities to collect personal information, not only personal information, but things like building plan information, all sorts of things that are posted, not necessarily that the individual is submitting to an agency for a purpose that they thought might end up on the web. So I would like that considered for the future.
Good comment. Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Dr. Robinson, we do a lot of work, and I have to say, because I serve on this foundation council. But my question to you, and it was raised by Senator Bates, for you to consider the other risk factors, and he talked about defensive medicine. And I want to add to that defensive medicine posture, because you happen to, as Oregon State at the university, you're at a much higher risk sometimes than the other hospitals, because you're taking patients and individuals who cannot be treated or whose problem cannot be solved in other facilities in the state, particularly when we look at pediatrics. It poses some terrible risk. And what if you're not able to have the kind of liability protection, if we're not able to have the resources, I'm looking at resources now, because you're talking $30 million for 1 year for premiums, and if we don't get a handle on that, we're at $120, $130. What impacts will that have on really the service piece? I mean, one of those who's out there trying to raise more money for you for pediatrics and brain, particularly, as most of you know, my granddaughter was treated, had brain surgery twice at Dornbecker. And so I think when we think in terms of this issue, it's a lot more than talking about a cap. It's a lot more than talking about dollars. It's also an impact on the services to the not only citizens in Oregon, but I know that you also serve citizens in Clark County.
Co-chairs, Senator Winters, thank you for the opportunity to actually discuss that. This is something that's very personal to me. I've spent most of my career treating patients with pediatric retina problems. That includes the infants that have retinopathy of prematurity and are low birth weight, many of whom go blind. For many of those years, I was the only person in a 5-state region that would treat those infants, partly because we had a tort cap, partly because at OHS, we could take all patients regardless of their ability to pay, and quite honestly because I was willing to do it, and I was convinced that over the course of my career it would be one of the most satisfying things that I did. That proved to be the case. Unfortunately, the results, although much better now than they were when I began my career, are still often not what we want them to be. These are the highest of high-risk cases. If there is, many of these children do end up blind. No matter what you do, they make wonderful plaintiffs' cases, and we are actually going to have to closely monitor the outcomes in these cases and see if we will be able to continue to provide that service.
Further comments? Senator Berger.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair. I really recognize the seriousness of this topic, but I just can't let this go by that I don't recognize the reliable and dependable service of CIS over the years to cities and counties, and I don't often have an opportunity to do that, and so while they're in the room, I'd like to acknowledge that.
Thank you. Good comment.
Mr. Chair, Mr.
Senator Nelson.
Just a quick conflict of testimony. Mary Williams basically said simply raising the cap is not the solution, but based on your testimony, it's saying that brings some certainty if you have a cap. So where do we sit with that?
Co-Chair, Senator Nelson again. I also put in the disclaimer that I did not have the wisdom of Solomon. My personal belief is that while a cap is not the entire answer, it does provide us some immediate relief. And in the effort to provide the most for the most, that relief, although perhaps not the entire effort, would be greatly appreciated.
Mr. Merrill, would you like to come up and make a brief comment in response to Senator Nelson's question? Put it in context, perhaps, for us.
Thank you, Co-Chairs. Mary Williams again from the Department of Justice. The reason I say that raising the cap isn't an answer is that what raising the cap does for the state is it simply allows more of the claims that we have to deal with to fall within the tort claims cap, so we're not talking about what sort of additional coverage we may have beyond it. And largely what it means is we can then self-insure for more of those claims, but the costs are still going to be significantly greater if we increase the cap for the payout for those claims. So what it does is it will make the pool of claims that will exceed that cap smaller, but it isn't an answer in the sense that it's going to eliminate this increasing cost that we're going to have to deal with as a result of this decision.
That makes sense. And I think the comment was made that, you know, we have, you know, how we conduct policy and the safeguards we put in place of how we do things and get them universally accepted as standards of care would hopefully go a long way towards helping things. Senator Carter, are you going to bring this home?
I just wanted to go back and remind us of what our counsel had told us, and that this decision has created more questions than it has answers. And I think that's the one thing that we as a legislature have to remember. I was here in 91, and I'm telling you, folk, it's something when you bring all of our people across this state together to talk about tort liability, period. And to not bring any of the players to the table is going to be a genuine mistake, number one, because but what we have to realize is that the answer, some of the solutions to what we have facing us is going to be faced with by this body, and we can't put it off because we have too many other people who are counting on us to be able to bring some solutions to this problem. And I'm not talking about this month, February. I'm talking about as we go forth and make good policy, that we have too many other entities that are counting on the state to bring the entities together to find solutions to this problem, and that with our council putting on record that many more questions were asked and there were solutions for at this particular time, that I think a hint to the wise should be sufficient, and that we can't count on DAS to be the person that brings these solutions, because like Chris has said, they have to depend on general counsel, risk management, everybody else collectively to find some solutions to this problem. But as we have done in the past, I'm sure we will do it again.
Thank you. Sounds like there's a lot of interest in that interim work group having that go. I would just suggest that, you know, people like Dr. Bates with some background be part of that group, should that be formed, and certainly someone on the House side with equal expertise, maybe more than one or two people. I think that's real critical. It's not, well, I respect my judiciary colleagues. I think, you know, we also see the big picture, and it should be somewhat inclusive. Maybe the co-chairs would be interested in writing some sort of letter to leadership, encouraging them to move forward with the urgency that my co-chair talked about. I appreciate it. Big issue, and I appreciate the testimony. It really helps us understand the magnitude, if you will, of the issue. Thank you very much. There's information also. We don't have to make a motion. Other things come before the body at this point?
I'd like to welcome Senator Joanne Verger back, and all of us keep her in our prayers. She lost her sister, and it's always tough when you live that many miles away, but she has obviously weathered the storm, and we're glad to have you back.
Thanks, we are. All right, with that, we'll adjourn, and then... 2 days of exciting DHS stuff coming up.